Today is Friday, April 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Former President Idriss Deby is set to be buried in Chad, but what's the mood like?
Security is watertight. In fact, it is difficult to see people moving in town. There are soldiers just everywhere, and you could still see some fright among the few civilians, the few citizens. We met on the street.
Plus, food insecurity is on the rise in Myanmar. We'll have these stories and more next. Foreign leaders began to arrive in Chad Thursday for the funeral of President Idriss Deby as France backed the country's new military leaders in the face of threats from rebels to resume an offensive on the capital. Reporter Moki Edwin Kinzika is in Chad and shared what he's seeing.
Security is watertight. In fact, it is difficult to see people moving in town. There are soldiers just everywhere, and you could still see some fight among the few civilians, the few citizens we met on the street. I was asking them what was really wrong. They're saying that they're afraid of the unknown. They don't know what can happen tomorrow because they are threatening the whole place. But at the same time, they are saying they want to give a befitting burial to the man who had led Chad for 30 years, the late President Idriss Deby. Now, as you move along the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, you also see pictures, effigies, campaign messages with President Idriss Deby. You know the elections were held last month, so you could still see these pictures all over the town. But the message is just that there is fright almost everywhere. People are afraid of the unknown, and security has been deployed because we are told about 16 heads of state and government are going to be in N'Djamena for the funeral tomorrow.
You mentioned about uncertainty, fear of the unknown, and the fright that's causing people that you're seeing there. Does that have more to do with the president's son being appointed the new leader of the country and the military council? Or does that have something to do with the rebels who have vowed to carry on the fight and take it to?
Yes, it has to do with the appointment of transitional military council, military senior officials of the military led by the son, the 37-year-old son of President Idriss Deby Itno. They are promising to lead the country for 18 months and hand over to civilian rule. But the opposition and the rebels have warned, and seriously too, that they should hand over to civilian rule. Remember that the military decided to stop parliament and the National Assembly. So it is the fear, that's what the fear of the unknown in the town, because nobody knows what is going to be happening tomorrow. The rebels are threatening. They gave the military council up to last night, that is the night of Thursday, to bury President Idriss Deby. And they are saying that any foreign head of state who comes to N'Djamena as from midnight yesterday is at his own risk. They cannot assure them of security. That is where the fear of the unknown is coming from. And also the fact that people here have been receiving threats on social media, over social media platforms, from people they don't even know. So they're complaining that it is not easy for them. They cannot go out. They are threatened. Their lives are not safe. The military is everywhere in town. That is just what is happening here.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, France has come out and said that it does support the military takeover with this council because of the situation with the FACT rebel group and the fight against the insurgents. How do people feel about the international response, President Deby's death?
You know, France is the country that is highly criticized out here by civilians, by Chadians. People here are feeling that France is intruding into the affairs of Chad. They're asking why, instead of asking the military to hand over to civilian rule, France is instead supporting the military. And so they're questioning the democracy, type of democracy France is practicing and wants to impose on Chad. The people here are also so angry that Cameroon, which is a neighboring state to Chad, has also been supporting the military council. The head of state of Cameroon, President Paul Biya, sent a sealed letter to the son of President Idriss Déby, Mahamat Déby, who is leading the military council, extending his support to Chad. So people are not really happy here with that type of support, because most people think that they have been in a dictatorship for a very long time, and they wanted democracy, they wanted power to be handed over democratically. They were disgruntled with the Idriss Déby regime for being so long in power, and thought that the world would have come in now instead to say democracy should prevail. They should hand over the democratic rule.
Really quickly, the funeral for President Déby is slated for Friday. What can you tell us about what's going to happen and what concerns there are?
The only issue is that of the uncertainty I was talking of. So that the Chadian president is coming and the rebels are threatening. They are found in the north. Also, President Idriss Déby is going to be buried in his hometown in the north, where the rebels are also around. But the governing council, the military council, think that they are up to the task, that they are in charge, and that they can take control.
That was Moki Edwin Kinzika speaking to me from the Chad capital in N'Djamena. The U.S. State Department again extended its condolences to the people of Chad for the loss of President Déby and condemned the recent violence in the country. Spokesperson Ned Price.
And as I said yesterday, we support a peaceful and democratic transition of power to a civilian-led government. Obviously, developments in recent days and hours are a cause for concern, but we will continue to call for and support a peaceful, democratic transition to a civilian-led government.
Price added that the violence in Chad is disturbing and that the situation is fluid. The UN Security Council expressed concern on Thursday about the humanitarian situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Among their concerns is the abuse of women and girls, a week after the UN aid chief said sexual violence was being used as a weapon of war. It was the first public statement by the 15-member council. It's been briefed five times privately on the conflict since fighting between Ethiopia's federal government troops and Tigray's former ruling party began in November. The council was unable to agree on language last month, with Western countries pitted against Russia and China, whose diplomats question whether the body charged with maintaining international peace and security should be involved. Food insecurity is rising sharply in Myanmar in the wake of the military coup and deepening financial crisis, with millions of more people expected to go hungry in the coming months. That's the word from the United Nations on Thursday, and Reuters' Olivia Chan is up next.
Up to 3.4 million more people in Myanmar will struggle to afford food in the next 3 to 6 months, the United Nations said on Thursday. The country has plunged into political turmoil after the army seized power from the democratically elected civilian government on February 1st. With added economic pressure from the global health crisis, Myanmar is battling a deepening financial crisis. The World Food Programme said market prices of rice and cooking oil had risen by 5% and 18% respectively since the end of February. There are signs that families in the commercial capital, Yangon, were skipping meals and eating less nutritious food. The World Bank forecast Myanmar's GDP to contract 10% in 2021. The agency's analysis shows that urban areas will be worst affected, as job losses are mounting across manufacturing, construction and services. The World Food Programme plans to expand its operations to help 3.3 million people, tripling the number of people it helps. It is appealing for $106 million to achieve this goal.
Reuters reporter Olivia Chan. United Nations spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric shared what the UN Secretary General hoped would come about from this weekend's ASEAN meeting. The head of Myanmar's junta will meet with other regional leaders.
The Secretary General is hopeful of a very strong, unified voice from ASEAN. ASEAN as a sort of as a unit has a very important role to play in helping us achieve the goal that we all want, which is a return to civilian rule in Myanmar. Different ASEAN countries individually also have important voices and important roles to play. So we hope to see a strong message come out of the meeting.
An upcoming NATO summit will cover key global security questions. And AP correspondent Charles Della Desma has that story.
President Joe Biden and other leaders of NATO countries plan to discuss tense ties with Russia and China, the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, and the future of the 30-nation military alliance at the June 14 gathering. The NATO headquarters in Brussels meeting will be a face-to-face opportunity for Biden to rebuild relations with leaders from Europe and Canada that became strained under former President Donald Trump. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says this is a unique opportunity to reinforce NATO as the enduring embodiment of the bond between Europe and North America. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Russia announced Thursday it was ordering troops back to base from an area near the border with Ukraine, apparently calling an end to the buildup of tens of thousands of soldiers that had alarmed the West. A confirmed pullout of the troops brought it on top of the permanent contingent will likely be welcomed by Western countries. They had been expressing alarm at the prospect of further Russian intervention in eastern Ukraine. Russian-backed separatists have been fighting the Ukrainian government in the region since 2014. The Ukrainian president's spokeswoman said this month that Russia had more than 40,000 troops deployed on Ukraine's eastern border and over 40,000 in Crimea. Around 50,000 of them were new deployments, she said. Moscow has not provided any troop numbers. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that would make Washington, D.C. the 51st state, sending it to the U.S. Senate for consideration. I asked VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson about the measure and why now.
Well, you know, this is the second time in 2 years that the U.S. House of Representatives, the Democratic-led U.S. House of Representatives, has passed legislation that would make D.C. the 51st state in the United States. Of course, the thing that has changed significantly is the makeup of the U.S. Senate, where that bill would have to pass in order to go to the president's desk to be signed into law. Now, the numbers are not too terribly in favor of the Democrats still, but there's this talk that some of the Senate rules may be changed now that there's a Democratic president in the White House, the so-called filibuster, that would then allow Democrats to pass that legislation with the numbers they need to get that going. If they decide to tear apart those Senate rules, change everything so that it can go to President Biden's desk, then that would be a significant development because, of course, then D.C. would get two senators and members of Congress who would have voting representation in the U.S. Congress.
Catherine, can you kind of give us a little background on the push for D.C. statehood? I mean, going back to American history, it's often taught that one of the reasons for the American Revolution was a call to end taxation without representation. And here we are 200 years later, and D.C. still doesn't have voting voices in Congress.
Absolutely. You know, there is a non-voting representative in the U.S. Congress who represents D.C. but is not allowed to vote on legislation. Her name is Eleanor Holmes Norton, and she has been active in this push for years and years. And part of the struggle of getting statehood for Washington, D.C. is that a lot of people around the rest of the country don't realize that the nation's capital on all its residents don't have voting representation in Congress. There's been a lot of work in recent years to educate American voters and tell them, look, D.C. is its own particular place with an identity, with 700,000 residents, which is as many or more residents than two full U.S. states, which have their own senators. So a lot of the battle is just getting people to understand that this is a place all its own and that it does pay taxes, contribute to the American economy, send people off to war, just like residents and citizens all around the rest of the United States. Right now, as public polling stands, about 54% of Americans support D.C. statehood. Democrats said that once this bill passes, there'll be a lot more awareness of this issue, and they expect that public support to go up significantly.
Where do things stand with doing away with the filibuster? Because right now, to call a vote on something like this, you do need 60 senators to call for cloture, to bring the bill to the Senate floor for a vote. And some Democrats have said they aren't willing to do away with the filibuster. So that seems to be, as you said, a roadblock into moving this measure forward.
Absolutely. And it doesn't just pertain to legislation making D.C. a state. We're talking about many, many other landmark pieces of legislation for the Biden administration that all of Washington wants to know. Look, are they going to nuke the filibuster, do away with that rule that would allow President Biden to really get some big pieces of legislation through without Republican opposition? And that's the number one question here in Washington right now. A couple of Democratic senators have said, look, they're really uncomfortable with doing away with the rules that make the U.S. Senate the U.S. Senate, a deliberative body that doesn't just speed through legislation, that has that higher threshold to make sure that that safeguard is in place. And then, of course, we also have some Republican senators who are saying, you know, look, I am somewhat on the side of D.C. statehood. There's something that I would have to consider. But in the end, they are going to stick with their party and they are going to draw those battle lines, because when it comes to the filibuster, this would dramatically change the way the U.S. government operates. This would really be a game changer, particularly in the Biden presidency.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. It's been nearly a year since George Floyd was killed by a former Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer who pressed his knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Friends and family welcomed the conviction of Floyd's killer, Derek Chauvin, but continued to mourn his death. Issa Shirai has more from Minneapolis.
Those who knew George Floyd intimately, like friend Tiffany Cofield, continue to mourn him even after the conviction of his killer, former police officer Derek Chauvin.
Like a piece of my heart is gone. Like I'm never going to get it back. Like how do you replace somebody that's irreplaceable? And so it's hard to grieve when you're angry.
Those who knew Floyd describe him as a caring, community-oriented individual.
The love he showed to his community, to the youngsters, the ones he mentored. Like, people don't talk about that. You know, it's not the sensationalism. But he was really a big-time community guy. Like, he knew all the senior citizens. He helped them walk across the street. He carried their groceries. Like, he would do homework with his nieces and nephews.
And so, Tiffany Cofield believes Floyd would have loved George Floyd Square, the memorial created on the block in Minneapolis where he was killed. The neighborhood maintains the memorial, where free food is available for members of the community.
Hey, I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, come up here, clean up all the paper all the way around here, put up boards on the window, take down the boards, you know, whatever need, you know, to be done up here. So that's, you know, that's exactly what I do.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm cooking and cleaning.
A lot of visitors also, of course, came to the memorial, but there's a group of people that they are caretaker of the memorial from the neighborhood who lived here for a long time.
No justice, no streets.
In the wake of the guilty verdict, Floyd's family and supporters are calling for change in America's policing system.
I'm very confident in saying that the family as a whole is definitely pushing for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act to be passed by Congress.
For us here in Minneapolis, like as you heard today, there is a widespread, you know, a full investigation about the MPD.
But Tiffany Cofield says there can be no true justice because Floyd's family will never be reunited with the man they knew and loved. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Minneapolis.
India reported over 300,000 new COVID-19 infections Thursday. That's the highest one-day total posted by any nation during the year-long global pandemic. The devastating second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic in the world's second most populous country has brought its healthcare system to the brink of collapse, even in its biggest cities. Experts say that super spreader events and a more infectious variant could have caused a surge in India that is now the epicenter of the global pandemic. Anjana Pasricha takes it from here.
Patients sharing beds in a New Delhi hospital. In India's shuttered cities, the only crowds are outside hospitals and crematoriums as families scramble to get beds or cremate loved ones. The exponential rise in COVID-19 cases as a second wave grips India has brought health services to breaking point, even in cities like Delhi and Mumbai with the best equipped hospitals.
The influx of patients is so much that we have to treat on the wheelchair. Sometimes you have to treat it in the ambulance itself.
It is the worst public health emergency in memory, as hospitals run desperately short of beds, medical oxygen, and key drugs.
It was worse than a tsunami. It was worse than carpet bombing.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi has called India's second wave a storm.
Corona sankat mein desh ke anek hisse mein.
The coronavirus crisis has led to a massive demand for oxygen throughout the country. We are taking steps to address this very quickly.
Aur puri samvedanshilta ke saath kaam kiya ja raha hai.
It will be too late for those already mourning dead relatives.
Mere mishe the na idhar kal ye time ko laya tha.
I brought my wife here in the night and she was well and talking to me. Around 2 a.m. in the night, she told me that she is not getting oxygen and the hospital is not providing it to her.
Authorities have been criticized for allowing super spreader events such as a massive Hindu religious festival and packed political rallies led by top leaders in recent weeks. Experts say a more infectious variant is also driving the relentless rise in cases.
It's known that this variant is more transmissible. It moves more easily between people, and it is able to evade the immune response in some cases.
The second wave that has made India the epicenter of the global pandemic is not expected to peak soon.
In a situation where cases are rising very rapidly, we're already a little below 300,000 cases reported yesterday, and we're at about 2,000 odd deaths. Our vaccination program is faltering a little bit. We were a little below 3 million vaccines yesterday. So all of this together suggests that the next couple of weeks is not going to be good for India. We have to be strong.
That will be a challenge for an exhausted healthcare system.
I think we are nearly crumbled and crashed, I should say. I don't know how we are going to resurrect. Let's all vaccinate everybody. Let's all save lives. Let there be more beds. Let there be more oxygen.
That is also the cry from people questioning why authorities did not prepare adequately to handle a second wave. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Joe Biden has kicked off a two-day virtual global summit on climate Thursday, which was also Earth Day. He pledged to substantially reduce U.S. carbon emissions by 2030 and double annual climate change funding to developing countries by 2024. 40 world leaders, as well as climate activists and representatives of international organizations, are attending the summit. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara has the details.
As President Joe Biden convened the virtual today, climate summit of 40 world leaders, he made an ambitious commitment to cut U.S. carbon emissions by 50% to 52% below 2005 levels by 2030. The U.S. Mr. aims President, to lead again on tackling climate change following the Trump administration's withdrawal from the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. Biden's new target is double the commitment made by the Obama administration, and the hope is that other countries will also go further before the November UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow.
The steps our countries take between now and Glasgow will set the world up for success. To protect livelihoods around the world and keep global warming at a maximum of 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Some, including leaders of the European Union, Japan, and Canada, announced new targets, as well as Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, often criticized for policies that speed up the deforestation of the Amazon.
I determined that our climate neutrality should be reached by 2050, moving up the previous announcement by 10 years. A sinalização anterior.
But the world's largest CO2 emitter did not make a new pledge. China's rapid development means achieving carbon neutrality in such a short time frame will be a challenge, said President Xi Jinping.
China will strive to peak carbon dioxide emissions before 2030 and achieve carbon neutrality before 2060.
India, the world's third largest emitter, and Russia, the fourth largest, also made no new commitments. Meanwhile, developing countries sought new assurances on climate change financing from wealthy nations to help lower-income countries reduce emissions. These countries have historically contributed the least to global emissions, but often suffer the most from the devastating effects of climate change, said South African President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Consequently, developed economies
we hold the view, have a responsibility to support developing economies to enable them to mitigate and adapt to climate change.
In 2009, developed countries pledged to increase climate financing under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change to at least $100 billion per year by 2020. The promise has not been met, but Biden said Thursday he is renewing America's commitment to the pledge.
The United States will double its 2024 by 2024 our annual public climate financing development to developing countries.
The president announced the creation of America's first ever international climate finance plan, laying out steps for federal agencies to increase funding to developing nations. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
And finally, climate change and environmental pollution have made finding enough sea life to harvest more difficult for Jinu and other South Korean henya, or sea women. Reuters' Francesca Lanaw brings us their story.
I'm Jin So-hee. I'm 28 years old, and I'm the youngest haenyeo on Hoje Island.
South Korean haenyeo, or sea women like So-hee, spend their days free diving to the seabed to collect mollusks, seaweed, and other marine life to sell at local markets. But their centuries-old livelihood is under threat from climate change, environmental pollution, and advances in fishing practices.
These are the biggest ones. What do we do?
We should still catch them, though. There aren't any bigger ones.
The boss is going to be mad. He told us to bring in really big ones today.
The vast majority of living haenyeo are now over the age of 70. But So-hee and her 35-year-old partner, Woo Young-min, are on a mission to keep their tradition alive and salvage their seas. They've set up a YouTube channel called Modern Sea Women, chronicling their lives and work, which they hope will help their plight.
Through our YouTube channel, I hope the culture of haenyeo will be preserved and will be passed on to the next generation. And I hope subscribers have more awareness on environmental preservation.
Every year, the waters off the rocky shore of Hoje Island are a little less icy, warming as much as 2.6 times more than the world average, changing the undersea habitat and casting doubt on the future of the haenyeo. Since 2011, the South Korean government has been working to reverse the ocean desertification caused by climate change. The Marine Forest Creation Project involves planting new seaweed, which helps absorb carbon dioxide from the water and removes the invasive sea urchins that eat the marine plants. Jun Byung-hee is an official with the Korea Fisheries Resources Agency's Ecological Restoration Division.
If seaweeds disappear, it takes away a source of food for animals, spawning grounds and habitats. And this leads to a decreased amount of sea life and resources, and eventually ruins the marine ecosystem.
With less seaweed, which the haenyeo also harvest as food, the women increasingly have to dive deeper. It's becoming more physically challenging and dangerous every year, especially for the older divers, like 86-year-old Ko Bok-ha.
In the past, compared to the past, I retrieved 10 times the amount I retrieved today. It wasn't good today.
So-hee says she makes half the amount of money that she did last year and finds more golf balls than sea cucumbers. She worries that next year her income won't be enough to put food on the table, or that her job could disappear altogether because of climate change. But the haenyeo will keep on diving while they still can.
I'll keep working unless I'm sick. My wish is for the sea life to live until then, so I can continue this work.
Francesca Lanaw from Reuters News. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.